Down to Business with Bobby Kerr on News Talk.
Sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
Kick things off as we do most Saturdays. Have a look at some of the business and indeed some other stories making the headlines. I'm delighted to be joined by Susan Hayes Culleton of this parish, presenter of Taking Stock, and also by Ronan Reid of Cantor. Good morning, guys.
Morning, Bobby.
Morning, Bobby.
Now we'll start with, this was always coming, Ronan, energy and bin hikes as Iran cost crisis starts to bite.
Yes, I mean, it's the suddenness of suddenly energy prices when you have a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, when you have energy deficiency. I think this is the first of many. So clearly, prepay power have indicated they're raising their prices. To be fair, they hadn't raised it hugely before. And then I think on top of that, we have others talking about higher. I think it was some of the waste companies are saying higher prices because of fuel prices. And we've already seen the airlines cancelling flights in generally on jet fuel and on other aspects. But there's inevitability that this will go through. And it's not just oil. It's things like fertilizer. A lot of the fertilizer in the world comes through there as well.
Yeah.
So you can see prices and inflation prices are picking up and will pick up across the world. But there's no surprise, I think, that this is happening and will continue to happen. There doesn't seem to be an imminent resolution. The other thing I always think is when COVID ended, it took quite a while to unwind. So even when this ends, there always is a tail or a lag.
Long tail. Talking, I suppose, economics, Susan, the punter always pays. This is the reality here, that the price increase will find its way to the consumer sooner rather than later.
Well, Cliff Taylor has an interesting take on this, where he says Ireland's energy crisis nears its moment of truth. So indeed, he does start off by highlighting the fact that prepay power has been the first to come to the table on this. He's saying that's likely to be followed by Electric Ireland. But what I find interesting is when you talk about economics is that the annual progress report came out, which is what many of us know as a summary economic statement. The adverse scenario of inflation, adverse scenario, was 4.6% in 2027 for that. And yet Cliff Taylor today, he mentions, against the backdrop, as businesses face higher electricity and gas costs too, there'll be a general rise in the rate of inflation, which could well average above 4%. He's talking about that now as just being the normal one that we might anticipate. So it's interesting how the narrative is changing on this as well. The Eurozone inflation figures were out this week. There were 3% in April, and that's been the second consecutive month of breaching 2%. We're getting used to this in terms of the inflation figures. But now it's when it hits one's pocket. So you're right about the inevitability, as you say, Ronan, of this moving on. The question is now, how is it managed? And politically, there's going to be a big challenge around this, because of course we all remember the protests, and of course there was a sense that something had to be done. But now again, the narrative is moving to the fact that one industry, well, two we could say, namely hauliers and agriculture, is benefiting from the 500 million of supports. But the question politically now becomes, well, what happens to everybody else?
Yeah.
Because as you say, Bobby, the punter is paying. This is every household in the country. And they're not going to be happy with only one or two sectors benefiting from support from the state.
It's interesting. Cliff Taylor also tells us that, in effect, he says the government has enough spare cash to buy its way out of its problems for another year at least.
But he alludes to the bigger cost coming down the track, which is the national grid.
Yeah.
They reckon it's the largest infrastructure spend that we have coming up as a state. We have a very old electricity grid and connectivity. So even if we increase output, the ability of that grid to carry power is limited. And they're saying ultimately people will pay on parts of that. I think interesting prepay power. Prepay power is a business where you naturally prepay for the power itself. And I've often wondered, rather than just giving blanket monies away, can you not target it? Electronic payments, electronic cards. You can see Irish companies like Clever Cards and others that set it up so you can have some type of prepay.
Yeah.
So it's targeted would make an awful lot more sense.
And there was a lot of, I suppose, debate and criticism about the blunderbust approach,
yeah,
you know, to everybody getting and then trying to turn these off is also politically difficult.
But at the moment, I think there can be a criticism made, and sometimes with good merit, that the government is reacting to things a lot, that there's a knee-jerk approach taken. And I mean, we can go back to various different decisions that the government has taken over the past while. It's very difficult, though, to have long-term vision when you're dealing with things like this. And look, that's always been the case. You have that long-term versus short-term contrast all the time. But if it is the case that we are criticising our leaders in government now for not having long-term vision at the same time as criticising them for not giving out short-term support, it's like, I think we have to ask as a country, what do we really want here? And there's no doubt about it, we want more infrastructure, that's for sure. But it's, I think that we need to understand here about the narrative of, we know that universal payments isn't going to work. And also, the reality is the root cause of what's going on here has nothing got to do with what's going on in Irish Shores.
Yeah.
And no. It also, in the States, when they've done that over successful elections and others, which is just a dump of money, it leads to a very different type of electorate. And as you say, the core decisions don't get properly debated and you end up with a populist person in all the time. Like the US has always traditionally done, here's a dump of money, here's a dump of money. Whereas it needs to be targeted. And as you say, there needs to be a proper, like, ongoing in terms of the delivery of infrastructure. And some of it is, oh, we never deliver it, but we did deliver 15 years ago. So what's changed? What's gone wrong in how we deploy that? But the national grid, from anybody I talk in infrastructure, they go that that's one of the biggest spends coming down, bigger than Irish Water, bigger spend, and it has to be done.
And also remember as well that we have got a 9 billion surplus that we're aiming towards. Like, the money is there, which makes in some ways the government's job harder.
It does.
It does, because then you can't say, well, we don't have the money to do it.
Yeah.
And so the question is, and I think that it's really important, the point that Cliff makes here, he says, barring a deepening of the Middle East crisis, Ireland has the resources to deal with these issues. The question is whether it has the political capacity to do so.
Okay, let's move to the States. Let's move to the world. Trump not satisfied with Tehran's latest proposal for talks to the end of the world. We heard some clips of him there on the news, Ronan. Also seeing there, a bit of a spat with the Germans, with Friedrich Merz.
Yeah, he's pulling out 5,000. Yeah,
5,000 troops out of Germany. So he's upset with the Italians. He's upset with the Spanish.
He's NATO, upset with everybody.
NATO kind of, maybe not under pressure, but like, he really isn't getting his way in Europe.
He isn't, and he's coming closer and closer to midterms.
Yeah.
And fuel prices in the States are up 42%. The next nearest country is 24%. So he is facing a big challenge moving in. I thought Martin Turner's cartoon, if you look at it, when he's holding them up, here's all the wars we won. And when you look at it, Vietnam, Korea, and now we have yet another war that doesn't seem to have populist support, and you're coming into midterms. So I would suspect that part of that is he's not getting his way and getting more petulant.
Yeah.
And that's it. And I saw another article at one stage, I think it was about 2 weeks ago, about the timing of his tweets during the night. And you can see, like, it's all the way through the night and nighttime, and it's like the petulant child, I'm not getting my way.
Susan, what's your take on this? US versus Europe view?
Okay, well, what I think is interesting here is just the culmination of the different views, because if we contrast how Europe is handling this versus the UK, I mean, the UK had really tried to be nice to them, basically, and it seemed to be working. If we go back to the trade
even
tariff,
deploying view, the king.
Even before the king, if we go back to Keir Starmer, I mean, I remember this time last year, we were looking at the UK after Liberation Day and saying, you know, they were looking at tariffs of 10%, whereas the EU was looking at it to be higher. So it seemed that that was working. Whereas now we see that it doesn't take long before a basis of a relationship with the US, and by the US when I mean directly with Trump, it's so volatile, it can change an awful lot. So therefore it looks to be standing up to him works as long as you've got enough backing behind you. But if we just keep spinning the globe here for the moment, it will be very interesting to see what happens in China later on this month. Very, very interesting indeed, because China is watching, I'd say, sitting back. And as they say, when your enemy is doing something to hurt themselves, don't interfere.
Yeah.
And that, I think, that's where I'll be watching. And I'll be watching what Dennis Staunton's take will be on it at the time.
Ronan, electric car sales surge 110% in April amid the fuel protests and the rising pump prices. Yeah, it's kind of almost easy to think maybe I should get an electric car now.
Yeah, and also the technology is improving.
Yeah.
Like the range of vehicles, build your dream. other cars are coming in. People have talked about it a lot of time, particularly Asian markets, China markets, cars that would have longer and more effective. So they seem
diesel,
to be through the
hook. Diesel cars dropping by 30% from last year.
Yeah, so and there's no surprise. I mean, like, at the end of the day, when you start seeing on the news big long queues at fuel pumps, not so much here, but internationally, this will spur people in terms of what they're buying. And there's been a lot of uptake as well, I think, in solar as well.
Yeah.
And then the deals that are offered from solar to charge your car at night. So everything is gearing that way and the infrastructure improves. So I always
follow the money, Susan. Yeah, follow the money.
Yeah, I'm a bit surprised by the conversation that's had about EVs sometimes, because you'd swear everyone had one. Like, I mean, the reality is here is that of the total vehicle fleet in the state of 3.3 million, there's only 3% of the vehicle fleet are EVs. I think the headlines can often talk about the surge in the number of cars that are being bought, which of course they should. But at the same time, we're still predominantly diesel, first of all, and petrol secondly. The other thing too here is that I think it's interesting to look at the difference between urban areas and rural areas. Like, I live in an urban area now in Dublin. I come from a rural area in Cork. And the conversation when it comes to either range anxiety or the ability to charge your car or the reliability of it, like, it's saying 6.9% of Dublin registered cars are now EVs, but it's only 2% in Monaghan, Mayo or Roscommon. So yes, it's interesting to look at the new car sales, but I think look at the overall fleet is actually more interesting.
And 80% are now automatic, which is interesting.
Yes, and of the four drivers in our family, two of us are automatic, two of us are manual. Me and Dad are manual, but they say when you go automatic, you just don't go back.
And I think that's right. I went automatic and I didn't go back. And I
grey and black remained the favourite colours, but there was 4,331 green cars registered last year. That's green, the colour. Just some information I thought you'd like. What about pennies? The great story from Arthur, the Arthur Ryan days, Ronan.
It's
a huge Irish legacy.
Oh, it's a tremendous legacy. Retail. Your colour on cars is quite funny, because when they imported Japanese cars in the 80s and 90s, they saw them really cheap imported and didn't realise that in Asia, white is lucky for a car, and suddenly they had 10,000 white cars, which is not a popular colour of cars in Ireland. Suddenly we hear them. But pennies, what a great story. Yeah. Arthur Ryan, the build-up of the business, phenomenal over time. A global brand. And picked Primark. I remember seeing him Arthur Ryan interview before he retired, and he was asked, where did you get Primark? And he went, I don't know, I just made it up. Because it was JCPenney, couldn't take them on, so I just went with Primark. I mean, it is a brand, I think significantly, and within the article you can see further on, and I think this sits behind it, ABF are going to spin it off as a separate brand
and
float it off.
Sort of financial wizardry?
Yeah, financial, but not financial wizardry. I would say they look at companies like Inditex, which is the owner of Zara, and it trades on a much higher valuation the traditional ABF business.
Is it like two and two make five?
Yeah,
then?
Yeah, very much so. Some of the parts might be bigger, so you put it off. People might want to invest purely in it. Their strategy is unusual. They don't sell clothes online. They must be one of the few clothing retailers that don't. And when people do sell online, good friends of mine, Pam Scott would talk about it, but a lot of the retailers would look at their return rates are very high. So they've said, no, we want to drive footfalls into our stores, and then people do. So in banking terms, it's like permanent TSB. We have more branches. So this is more, we do not sell online, which is a very different strategy, but it is a massive global success story. I mean, you're talking about Middle East expansion, US expansion, really, really tremendous. And anybody that knew of Arthur Ryan, great character, and when he spoke, great character.
500 stores in 19 countries, Susan.
That's right. And 80% of their products retail at less than €10. I mean, that really is the defining characteristic, I think, of pennies. A few things about it stand out to me. One is that despite its low price, the retail experience of the store is still of a very high quality. It's not a load of stuff in the corner.
Yeah.
That is one of the things that stands out to me. Also, indeed, picking up on the point about that they don't have online commerce or e-commerce, but they're still very digitally strong. And that comes through in John Maher's piece today, is that the way in which they encourage, of course, TikTok to go viral and so on, the way in which that the website is like an inventory or geolocator of the products that you want. So we shouldn't think that e-commerce equals no digital. That's not the case at all. And also, the development of the business around the world, it's interesting. Obviously, there's a lot of focus here in Arthur Ryan. When I think of Primark, I think of Breed O'Donoghue.
Well, and the Gang of Four, as they're known.
The Gang of Four.
There was also
right.
Seamus Halford and Paddy Pryor.
I remember meeting somebody presenting on Walmart in the States, and it was at the time, it was in the 90s, looking at Dunn's and making the point they're going to have to go up market. So as you come in and you sell at a certain area, over time, other competitors do come in and you have to do it. So they are now aligned with more influencers, more specific sectors, trying to target a younger demographic. All the things you do, you look at strategically. Phenomenal. So,
and of course, Arthur Ryan came from Dunn's originally. So yes. it's interesting how it does that. I think aiming towards that lower price point, ordinarily we might think, okay, that is a socioeconomic dimension, but definitely younger shoppers. Yeah. It's very, very good at that. And then maintaining them all the way through their third level experience, or whether they're starting families and so on like that. It's a global success story, and with €9.5 billion in sales, and of course a new store opening in Manhattan this week.
Yeah. Yes, and I think the only challenge for them is, if clothes are that cheap, where are you sourcing them from? And clearly that has been a challenge in the past in terms of some of the sourcing and where it is. And they had a well-worn initiative that dropped away, which was moved. I'd say that's the only challenge.
A big challenge.
And it would also sit behind separately floating it off if you have ESG other criteria.
Ronan, let's move forward to AI. There's a survey out there saying that most employers say AI won't hit staff numbers. I'm not so sure.
Well, the survey is by somebody who provides office space. Yeah. So I think this pulse, I think if they provide there office space over the period. But then, you immediately follow on to the article that 30% of people have been interviewed by AI. So those two, for me, kind of contradict each other. If you're using it, whether it's recruitment or other business, AI is going to change. I always think there is a law of unintended consequences that you don't quite know how AI will deploy, but it will deploy. So you will see areas for aggregation of information, content, interview. And I would never have thought of the interviewing side of it, but 30% of people saying, and I think their comment on that is, it reinforced bias rather than allow it against it.
I really feel sorry for people going through 10 interviews, some of them hosted by AI, some of them whether you're not sure, and then not getting the job.
Well, I think the whole point about, are we going to lose jobs to AI, I think we need to ask a different question, because we're definitely losing tasks to AI. I mean, in our business, that's certainly happening for sure. I think every single person listening today, it's incumbent on everybody to become more AI literate, to make sure you're keeping up with the needs and demands of the workplace. And I think that is likely to be the greatest antidote. But the other thing too, the other thing I would say here is, I was at a medtech conference in Galway this week, and what I'm hearing is two totally different parallel tracks happening here. When it comes to big companies or very sensitive areas, like obviously clinical trials and patient data, they can't move at the same speed as, let's say, something like professional services, where you're taking anonymized data and so on like that. So I think sectorally, the speed at which AI can be deployed meaningfully is very, very different. And so I don't think looking at this from a broad brush point of view is the right way of doing it. And of course, it goes without saying, what's really going to increase is risks around cyber, the growth of cyber area. And of course, Anthropic's Mythos really has blown that open over the last while. So I think looking at AI in general across the workforce, it needs more nuance.
Yeah, and I think the concept of interviewing by AI is flawed. As a person who ran a business, you want your people out interviewing. You want to find out what's in the
big
market.
Time.
You want to see.
It's a human business.
But you also want to see the human interaction. Yeah. And you'll see something that you won't see in the answer somebody.
Do you see in the future then that there will be recruitment companies that will say, we specialise in human-based
interviewing? Yeah, I do.
Going to turn all the way back?
It's like the utilities company that says, we'll answer the phone and we'll talk to you.
Yeah,
they're the one I want. That's the one I want to do.
But it's also, if you're running a business and your own people know what people want to come and work for you, they get to understand it. And if they do that, it builds an understanding also your marketplace, because very often you're interviewing competitors, people that are coming from competitors. You learn a lot and people learn a lot. And I would always say to people, go out and interview, make sure you're there.
Big time.
Yeah.
You learn more interviewing than you do. You learn about your business. You learn about competitors. You learn lots of stuff by interviewing. Ronan, you've been around Stephen's Green many years. What do you make of the new
plans? Okay, this is where we will recognise an age bias here. This article is talking about the days of when Dunn's was there and Numo and others. Now, for you and me, that's the green cinnamon dandelion market.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you should see them here looking lovingly into each other's eyes as they're nostalgic.
My office was across the road from it for 20 years.
The green cinema used to bunk. When you bunked out of school, you'd go into the green
bunked
cinema.
Bunked out of school?
You two were learning dandelion a lot about market.
Yeah, yes. You'd go into the, yes, and you two in the dandelion market. All of that is there. But
isn't it amazing, Roland, when you think back, and it's just the way buildings kind of are. There was huge controversy at the time with what we have now. And some people say it's pastiche. Some people say, but now we love that and we don't want to change.
But things form part of your culture and they don't have to be. I was saying, I remember architecture students telling me one of the most iconic buildings for a while was Bosaurus because of the roof. And I was going, I wouldn't have seen it at that. But I did like the line, why not bulldoze Molly Malone's statue?
While we're there.
Let's get some context.
What do you think about this, Susan?
I hear Emma Nolan, all right, putting her tongue in her cheek a little bit during this. I mean, look, for me, Stephen's Green is one of those buildings. When I think of the first time that I was coming up to Dublin or during being a teenager, I think architecture really does matter. It matters for the user experience, if you want to call it that, of a retail experience or indeed just a tourism experience as well. Personally, I think we need to be clear with those who are designing the city that we do need aesthetics and there's plenty of ability for the designers in the city to be able to make that as well as utility.
Do you know, another big point here is the reconfiguration of the Stephen's Green Shopping Centre is going to accommodate 3,000 office workers. So they don't want as much retail.
They don't, and I think
so. They want to scale back, maybe make the units bigger and have much fewer of them.
And the point back to that is it drives out other brands, local types of retailers. When you look at it, when you walk down Grafton Street now, look at the amount of phone companies, the other companies. So you don't see traditional retailers and other businesses.
I welcome that development though, because I mean the population is increasing, the workforce is increasing. I think it's great that there's vision about where people are going to be.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Susan Hayes Cullerton and Ronan Reid, enjoy your bank holiday weekend and thanks for coming in to us.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr,
sponsored by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 8. News Talk. Conversation that counts.